Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Brad Wilson. Brad has been a professional software developer for more than 25 years. Along with Jim Newkirk, he has worked on the unit testing framework XUnit.net. Welcome, Brad.
Hello, hello.
So before we get into sort of the meat of things, would you care to just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of how you got started in the industry?
Sure. So the first time I programmed a computer was 5 years old, which sounds ridiculous, but in our library in elementary school. And they were Commodore PETs, and they had a little book, you know, hey, learn how to program. And I typed along and everything worked. I wouldn't say that, you know, masterful code, but that just sort of, you know, ignited my interest. Along the way, when I was growing up, I had a couple of Commodores. The first computer I had at home was a VIC-20, and then I upgraded to a Commodore 64, and then moved over to PCs right about the time that I got into college. I went to college for computer science at Central Michigan University. And afterwards, I guess about 93, it started, you know, the real work in earnest of being a software developer. I've lived on both coasts, even though I grew up in Michigan. And my first job was, you know, in Boston. I lived in Detroit, the Detroit area where I grew up, also Denver. And then now I live in the Seattle area and working my second trip through Microsoft. So worked on a bunch of stuff you've never heard of and a couple things you probably have. I worked at Microsoft on the patterns and practices team. I worked on CodePlex, which was Microsoft's open source repository. And I worked on this tiny framework called ASP.NET. You might have heard of that. And today I work on the App Center team, which helps people deploy and collect metrics and test applications, primarily mobile, Xamarin and iOS, but also macOS and WPF and more to come, Android, all kinds of stuff. So that's kind of my 20,000 mile an hour tour through my programming life.
Very cool. Very cool.
And you say you're a returning Microsoftie.
Yeah. So I left in 2012. I was working on the ASP.NET team at the time, and I went to a startup, a cloud startup called Tier 3, which was eventually bought by CenturyLink, who is our local telephone provider. They sort of missed the boat on cellular phones and decided cloud was how they were going to sort of become modern because, you know, copper lines are not really worth any money anymore. So they bought us because we had a fully functional cloud. And so that's kind of what I did. I was basically the technical leader of the team that, you know, ran a sort of like 14 locations across the world, both in infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, cloud provider. Worked there for about 4 years and then took 9 months off, drove cross country and back because I just wanted to go see friends and family and a bunch of people I hadn't seen. And the whole, hey, your startup gets bought, gives you the opportunity to take a little time off. So that was pretty exciting. And then came back and back at Microsoft again.
And working with XUnit, how did you get involved in that particular project?
When I started at Microsoft, Patterns and Practices, my manager for, well, 0 days technically was Jim Newkirk. He was the engineering manager at Patterns and Practices when I interviewed. But on the day that I started, his replacement also started. I worked there for about 15 months, and then he had actually left Patterns and Practices to go do CodePlex. And so I joined about a month before CodePlex launched. So he and I got to know each other through, through working together at CodePlex. And when he had come to Microsoft in, I think it was like 2003, 2004, somewhere around there, his framework that he worked on at the time, and basically version 2 of NUnit, couldn't really bring it with him. Microsoft wasn't a super open source friendly place at that time, especially not something that had a lot of heritage that they didn't control. So he really couldn't bring him with him. And he wanted to continue to work on unit testing, and he wanted to say, hey, you know, I've done this for several years. Why don't I start over now, knowing what I know now? And so, you know, he and I just basically started working on it as our 20% project. We used to work on it every Wednesday for quite a while. We actually never thought it would become open source. We always thought it would be an internal Microsoft project, because at the time Microsoft was investing in MS Test, and we didn't think that the PM who owned that was going to let us do it. But we managed to sort of trick him with mind control, I think, into letting us release it as an experiment. And that was kind of that. I mean, people saw it and said, oh, that's from the guy who did NUnit, I'll take a look. And, you know, it got some traction outside. It got a bunch of traction inside. Our first internal customer who wasn't a team that Jim and I was on was the Roslyn team, the compiler as a service team for .NET. The guys who do the C# and VB.NET compilers. But today, you know, you look around and pretty much everything that Microsoft does that's open source is using XUnit.NET. Not everything, but, you know, as many things as I can talk people into. And, you know, and it's, I'm just shocked, because Jim and I were very opinionated from the beginning, saying, you know, this is not going to be an NUnit clone. If you just want another version of NUnit, keep using NUnit. We're going to make a bunch of changes. We're going to do things that, you know, he and I had both been involved in agile development for quite a while. So, you know, let's take those lessons learned and make something new. So that's what we did.
So what are the main differences between XUnit and NUnit?
I would say it's a lot of little things, is really, as opposed to a big thing. There's a couple of big things, but, you know, primarily the little things that are different would be, we just, you know, as agile practitioners, as consultants, as people who go out and give talks on this stuff, we would see people falling into failure pits again and again. A good example, if you're not an NUnit or an MS Test user, you might not remember expected exception as an attribute. But it used to be that when your test was going to throw an exception, you put an attribute on top of the method which said expected exception, which seemed like a good idea at the time. It's probably a little bit of attribute overkill. But it turns out that that was really bad, because you don't know which line of code inside the test actually threw that exception. And you could end up with false positives really easily. And so, you know, we look at things like that. Another example is we looked at things like startup and teardown, setup and teardown, turning those into the .NET idioms of constructor and dispose, instead of having, you know, methods with attributes hanging off of them. Basically trying to leverage the language in the way that it should be leveraged, and trying to sort of find those pits of failure and turn them into pits of success, which turned into assert.throws, which today NUnit has. And I think probably one of the biggest measures of success is, you know, NUnit changed a lot of its surface area along the way based on ideas that Jim and I had. From the big perspective, the one thing that I will say has always been a driving feature for us is making sure that the framework itself is extensible. And so you will see like a cottage industry of testing frameworks that have been built on top of XUnit that are not, strictly speaking, unit testing frameworks. So, like, for example, you know, if you wanted to do a BDD style testing system, or, you know, even using a language, you know, special language like Gherkin, so like Cucumber, you can have Cucumber emit XUnit.NET tests. And so what happens is, because we have pretty extensive extensibility, it allows people to sort of leverage the fact that we've already written the runners, we've already done the Visual Studio integration, and they can just tweak things to make the tests look however they want them to look. They don't have to use our assertion libraries. They don't have to use our method structure. You don't even have to use methods at all. Like Gherkin's a great example. You're basically writing English and it turns it into XUnit.NET tests. So we wanted to make sure that we enabled those scenarios. And And then also enabled something which is really just starting to pay off now, which was source-based test discovery. Back in like the old days of ReSharper in 2005, 2006, their test runner, you could basically discover via source. So you didn't have to compile anything. As you were typing, you would sort of start to get those things in the margins that said, hey, there's a test here that I can run. And we made that like a first-class citizen of our framework, right? This is not just something that we enabled for ReSharper. And so just in the last year or two, the VS Test people, you know, the stuff that's built into Visual Studio, they've been able to take advantage of that for some pretty substantial performance gains, because not having to compile code, especially very large code, can be a pretty big win to show you, hey, there's tests available here. So that's kind of paid off as well. But I mean, at the end of the day, Jim and I has always said, you know, hey, we're going to build the thing that we want to use. And hey, if you want to use it, that's great. If you don't, that's cool too. You know, we reject a lot more features than we accept, as it turns out. So.
So have you always been big into unit testing, or are you a TDD proponent, or is it just one of the many tools?
Before I came to Colorado, so I lived in Denver before I lived in Seattle. Before I came to Colorado, I would say that I had very traditional sort of waterfall emergency kind of software development. You know, it's like what I would consider the typical software development practices of the 90s. And then when I got to Colorado, I was a CTO at a startup. And basically, the NUnit had just come out. .NET had just come out. We had been contemplating moving from C++ to either Java or .NET. And so we ended up moving to .NET. And that sort of started my unit testing sort of background. And that was probably about 2001-ish, around there. And so I've been an on and off practitioner of unit testing. I didn't really get a strong TDD bent until I came to Microsoft and started working with people who were hardcore TDDers, people like Brian Button, Peter Provost, Scott Densmore, were some of the people who had sort of immersed me in the into the TDD lifestyle. And so, in fact, I feel so immersed in it, I refuse to call it TDD anymore. I like to call it design by example, because when people think about tests, I like to tell them that, you know, this activity is a design activity fundamentally. Tests are the result of it, and they're a secondary benefit. But the point is to guide you in minimal design of components. So a lot of the talks that I end up giving, you know, especially in my early in my Microsoft career, were about XUnit and TDD and things like that. But and yeah, since, you know, 2005, I would say pretty much just been hardcore TDD unit tester. Doesn't mean I don't approve of other kinds of testing, although some people might think that just because XUnit.net is very focused on what we call developer tests, as opposed to, you know, integration tests or functional tests. But again, that extensibility that I talked about earlier was really us saying, you know, we're really about, you know, developer testing. And so we want to give you the best experience here, but you want to do other kinds of testing, you know, we'll give you the hooks into Visual Studio and into ReSharper and into CodeRush so that this stuff will work for you as well. And so, you know, today I would say, you know, my mix of tests tends to be, you know, 80 to 90% unit test style. So isolated interaction tests or state tests. And then the other 10 to 20% being, you know, functional. Let's take a big slice of the system minus the external dependencies like file systems, databases, et cetera, and test that whole slice together and see what happens.
And do you find that you're using like fixtures for that, or how do you make larger test scenarios for the applications that you're working on?
Depends on the kind of testing. So we do some browser automation testing, which doesn't involve XUnit.net at all. I like to use API testing as well, as particularly as my entry point into functional testing, especially of microservices that are, you know, very API forward. You know, it seems like the best place to test, your integration of the system as a whole, call APIs and see what happens while controlling your external systems. Those just tend to be straight up XUnit.net tests. Fixtures do tend to come into it when you need some kind of shared state. So, you know, if setting up the mock of the external world, or let's say you even decide you want to test against the database, getting that database set up and connected to will tend to be something that we end up putting in a fixture.
What's new with XUnit?
I would say the last, probably the last 18 to 24 months has been focused on .NET Core. And it's changed my mind a little bit about the design of the system. In test runners today, it's very common to say your unit test project is a class library, and then you have some external executable that you're going to use to run that class library. And I've actually changed my mind. .NET Core and some of the devices stuff has really sort of clued me into the idea that your unit tests are the program. And so XUnit v3 is going to be based on the idea that when you compile your unit tests, it will be a standalone program. It'll basically be a console runner if it's, you know, targeting .NET Core or desktop CLR, or it'll be a graphical runner or whatever. But in addition, it'll have some way to communicate with an external runner if you want. So, you know, how do you get ReSharper, CodeRush, Visual Studio plugged in? You want to be able to launch this process in some kind of an IPC mechanism to say, hey, tell me about tests. Please run these things. Give me results. We had mechanisms like that built into XUnit.net already in support of app domains for desktop CLR. And so translating these into, you know, cross-process instead of cross-app domain things probably isn't all that difficult. And will still allow us to have this notion of a runner that lives separately from your test process. But it will still be, you know, when you launch your tests, you're launching a separate process for those tests, whether the results get shown in Visual Studio or you're just running it from a command line with .NET run or whatever.
So do you think we'll start to see, after that version comes out, do you think we'll start to see a lot of graphical plugins for XUnit that will allow it to maybe display a really nice web page or WPF application or something that highlights how the test ran and all the metrics?
I think maybe. And here's a bit of my hedge. In XUnit v1, we had a GUI, which we never got out of what we would call the experimental stage. And the reason we always called it experimental was we're horrible at graphical UIs. Like, we tried several times. I don't know anything about WPF. And Jim didn't know anything about WPF. And so we tried several times to say, let's WPF this thing. Let's make it look better. And it always ended up looking worse, which is pretty impressive. There is somebody, I think, who has taken that code or some code like that and ported it to WPF. And it's available as a NuGet package somewhere that you can download. So my guess is somebody at some point will probably do something like that. On the devices side, we already have a sort of graphical runner, but it even looks worse than our Win32 UI used to look. No offense, Oren Novotny, who is responsible for that. It's literally just like a WPF app that, you know, here's a list of tests and I'll run it and I'll show you the results. I mean, it makes really no effort to be a nice test UI. But the value of it is it runs on the device. So you can run it inside of a device emulator or you can literally run it on your phone. And so that's kind of the core thing. And you know, the V3 version of this is you'll still be able to launch that thing on your phone. We'll find some IPC mechanism, probably be a socket of some kind to talk between that thing and VS Test. And then, you know, I'll let the people at Visual Studio and ReSharper and CodeRush. I mean, you guys are better at this UI than I am, so keep knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, I'm still a big fan of using nCrunch inside of Visual Studio. I think for me, I'm really used to how they display the tests and how I might configure it to work best with my workflow. So,
yeah, and the cool thing about nCrunch is you can set up an army of build machines, test machines, and so you can say, hey, just run all these, and it looks around and goes, I have 10 machines doing nothing. Here's how fast I can run them for you. That's a really cool idea.
Yeah, but then you have to go to your coworkers' machines when they're unlocked and they're not at their desk and install it.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, you know, when we ran a cloud, we always could find extra VMs somehow. I don't know how that was, but, you know, we'd always find them somewhere. But yeah, I totally understand. And in our, honestly, on our team, we have people who are, you know, giving up desktop machines by the droves, and we just put them through PC Recycle. You know, you could just throw them in a corner somewhere and just let them do their thing. So
I got three over there.
I only have one at home, but I have two at work. I'm still a desktop PC lover, but my main dev box now at work is an XPS 13 laptop. Little tiny powerhouse. It's pretty fun.
So do you work on the main campus there?
I do, yeah. Our team, the App Center team, is kind of like 150 people. I would say probably a half of them or less, I should say, or fewer, work on the Redmond campus. We have people in other locations that sort of collate together. Some people in San Francisco, some people in South Korea, some people in Denmark. And then we have a bunch of people who are just one-offs working on their house, including people who live here who, you know, they were coming in every day and the whole team's like, half the team is remote. Why should we be here? And everybody else says, that's a really good idea. So they come in like once a week, maybe. Like, I know one of the guys who works on our team lives on a houseboat in Lake Washington. So, you know, it's like, I went and visited his houseboat. I'm like, yeah, I could see, you know, working from the boat, especially when it's nice. Wow.
And XUnit is part of the .NET Foundation now these days. What is that like from your side of that organization?
So that's kind of interesting, right? I mean, the life cycle of who owned XUnit started out with Microsoft in 2007 when we released the first version. When Jim and I left, we basically, just before we left, well, he had left a little earlier than I did, but when I left in 2012, we were just finalizing getting that handed over to the OuterCurve Foundation. So we were with OuterCurve for a little while, and now we're with the .NET Foundation. OuterCurve kind of, you know, disappeared of sorts. But the .NET Foundation, I mean, was a perfect home for us. From our perspective, like, we asked exactly one thing out of it, and it does an exceptional job at that, which is deal with contribution license agreements. So when people contribute code, you know, make them sign the document. And because .NET Foundation only makes you sign that document one time, no matter how many .NET Foundation projects you contribute to, it really lowers the bar of entry for people to submit pull requests. Theoretically, I mean, you know, if we had legal troubles, they would defend us. I don't know who we'd have legal troubles from. You know, Microsoft originally owned the code and gave it away to OuterCurve, who gave it to .NET Foundation. It certainly wouldn't be Microsoft. And, you know, we're on good terms with the NUnit guys. So, like, I'm sort of out of people who might be upset. So I don't think we're ever going to take advantage of that. I'd actually talked to John Galloway, who's sort of in charge of the technical side of the .NET Foundation, and maybe more than that. I may be downgrading him. Sorry about that, John. About the possibility of live streaming some coding stuff and maybe even having some community discussions about XUnit v3 on the .NET Foundation YouTube channel. Hasn't really happened yet, just because, frankly, the XUnit v3 stuff is still very early planning stages for me. It remains a weekend kind of project. And I just, you know, over the last 3 or 4 months, I've been very busy. And so I'm literally now just getting the time where I can sit down and start to work on it again on the weekends. And so, like, I've got OBS installed and I'm doing my screen layouts and I'm ready to go, I think. And I might stream for a little while on Twitch and on my own personal YouTube, just kind of get my feet wet before I embarrass myself in front of a much larger audience.
How's the sort of open source contributions? How has that been with XUnit? I think earlier you mentioned having to not accept you know, many pull requests maybe as you would expect or something like that. But could you talk about sort of like the contributions that have been made and what that process has been like?
Sure. The most valuable contribution by far to us is opening issues. Whether that's bugs or features, you know, that's sort of our go-to since we moved to GitHub, because we obviously started on CodePlex because we were working on CodePlex at the time we were working on XUnit. Since we moved to GitHub, I think we've had something like about 2,000 issues and pull requests. So a decent number. I wouldn't say huge because, you know, I think the move to GitHub was about 2011, 2012. So, you know, that covers a good 6 or 7 years at least. Number pull requests is fairly small. And I think some of that was when we first started and it was a Microsoft-owned project, they basically were calling it shared source, not open source, because they were not willing to take any contributions back. When we moved to GitHub and got out of the Microsoft sphere and then into Outer Curve, obviously part of that move was to open it up to the community at large. But at that point, we were already working on version 2. So we had already had, you know, I would say a solid 5 years of just me and Jim. And if you looked at the history, it looks like just me because we would pair and I would get to do all the commits. Because Jim's older than me and I type faster than he does. So he likes being the strategy and I'm the tactician. So, you know, I'd say the number of pull requests is actually tends to be fairly small, especially compared to, you know, the Microsoft projects. As soon as, you know, the ASP.NET stuff opened up, I mean, they were just bombarded with pull requests. And I don't know that it's, you know, attributable to one thing or another. I do think that some of it is, you know, we made clear from the beginning that we're pretty opinionated. We want people to open issues before they open PRs and have discussions. But, you know, by and large, most of the PRs have been, you know, centered around bug fixes. I've actually had a decent number from the Microsoft.NET team themselves because they use XUnit. And they would be like, yeah, your use of link here is 14 times slower than a for each. Here, let me fix that for you. And things like that, because, I mean, I think, you know, I've worked on projects that have a lot of unit tests. I think, you know, hey, 5,000, 8,000 unit tests, that's a lot. And then they come by and they're like, yeah, we have 250,000. And so can you make this? Because every 10 nanoseconds you take away times 250,000, that's a lot. So, yeah, we get a lot of those kinds of things, too. So a lot of our, I would say a lot of our substantial engine changes have come from, you know, the 2-3 decade old Microsoft engineers on the .NET team. So that's also been really cool and a big learning experience for me because I always thought I was okay at performance work, but yeah, these guys put me to shame for sure.
Very cool. So you have 25 years of experience. You've done a lot of things. What would you sort of like looking back on all of that, what would you say to someone who's just getting started if there's one or two things that you could just pick out?
Yeah, boy, that's a tough one. I think people should not be afraid of failure. And I mean that both on a personal and a team level, that you learn the most when you fail from things. And this is not specific to software engineering, right? I mean, this is life. You don't, when you do things and you're constantly successful, you're not necessarily evolving and learning all the things you need to know. When you sort of stretch the boundaries and break things and people get upset at you, that's when you really start to learn, you know, first of all, how to not get people upset at you, how to break the rules without getting in trouble. But I mean, also, you know, failure is how you get your next best idea. And in some ways, you look at XUnit V2 and, you know, hey, we continue to load DLLs because that's what we've always wanted to do, you know, ever since 2006 when we first started it. And you're like, okay, that is a long-term failure, even though it was a short-term success, right? And so we learn, you know, we've always been talking about this thing. It's like, yeah, your unit tests are a program. We're like, yeah, we should actually do that. Like, that fixes a lot of problems. Why did we wait so long to do this? So, yeah, that would be my first thing. I think my second thing would be, and this is, you know, it just seemed like just general advice, but, oh, my God, save your money. And save it in a way that builds up interest because compounding interest is magical. This is probably my last programming job. I think, you know, when I'm done here on the App Center team, I think I'm probably going to semi-retire, which means spending more time on XUnit, which is good for everybody else. But I'm also looking for something that's just completely different as a way to pay the bills. I've always been a huge fan of animals. So I've been thinking about going back to school and becoming a veterinary technician.
Cool.
I like that'd be kind of a fun way to spend, you know, 20 hours a week as a way to pay the bills and not, you know, dig into my savings too much, but still give me plenty of time to do the software development that I probably will do until the day I die, which for now is XUnit.
Awesome. Do you have any upcoming speaking engagements or anything like that?
I don't. I used to do a lot of speaking when I worked in Patterns and Practices and at ASP.NET because these were sort of, you know, things that were very developer focused. And so I had, you know, very deep knowledge in very specific places. And people love to have technical talks by people who really can dive deep into subjects. Now, where I work now, I don't work on any particular features. I sort of work on enabling the team as a whole to work better. And so, like, I don't have the deep technical knowledge to go talk about this stuff. So for the most part, it's you know, PMs and sort of the frontline devs who do most of the talking these days. That said, you know, every once in a while, you know, people will want to have conversations about XUnit or some of the other stuff I've worked on that's open source. Like I worked on with Damien Gard, I worked on a link provider for Elasticsearch. So I gave a couple of talks about that. And so, you know, I'll occasionally come out of retirement in a sense. I'm always happy to give talks. These days though, I mostly go and attend conferences, which is weird. For a long time, I would only go if I was speaking. So,
well, what about if people just want to like contact you or talk to you about XUnit or find out some more? Where can they find you?
Yeah, so the best place is to start at the XUnit website, which is xunit.github.io. And most of the conversations either happen like if you have an issue, like a bug or a feature you want, you can go open those on the GitHub project. Which we have several projects, but the main one is on github.com/xunit/xunit. But if you just want to have conversations, you want to ask questions, you need help or whatever, we actually have our own Slack server, and you can get an invite to that from the XUnit homepage. And so we have, I don't even know how many people are in that, some thousands of people are on that server. I don't even know. And a lot of people, you know, especially people who work on things that are adjacent to XUnit tend to be there. So like the guy who works on the ReSharper support and the guy who works in nCrunch and the guy who works on, you know, the CodeRush support, like they're all there and hanging around asking questions. It's a pretty low traffic group, though, as you might expect. A lot of people ask questions on Twitter. My personal Twitter is Brad Wilson, but XUnit also has a Twitter, so it's XUnit. People tend to tag both of us with questions, which is fine. It all shows up in the same place for me. So yeah, I mean, I tend to use Twitter as a way to sort of answer those quick questions.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Brad. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks. It was really fun.
That was Brad Wilson. Brad has been a professional software developer for more than 25 years. Along with Jim Newkirk, InUnit 2's author, he's worked on the unit testing framework xunit.net.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.